I wanted to talk a little bit this morning first about just the idea of Divine Mother. That chant that we were singing is a very dear one, and the whole concept of Divine Mother is a very interesting one, and I think a very important one for this particular time and place, meaning 2008 in America. There's been a great energetic movement in the last so many decades among women to assert a right to first to equality, and then sometimes that shifts over into a subtle sense of superiority, a feeling that, you know, male-dominated energy is not necessarily serving our planet or our society in the way that it ought to. And I mean, I've lived long enough to have sort of seen the more strident form of that kind of feminism crest and dissipate to a large extent. So now that women simply take for granted a great many things that my generation had to assert, one can still argue various inequalities in various parts of the world, but there's been no question that there's been a sea change. I mean, it's quite clear, we all know, seriously speaking of American politics, that we have a very serious possibility of a woman becoming president of the United States, which is utterly unprecedented. In fact, it's a remarkable reality, which everybody is telling you, other people are telling you, I don't have to say it too, that you have a black man and a white woman who are very real. One of them will either win or lose. And it's a real indication of a total shift of consciousness. Now, many things in this world happen from many different levels. They either happen from the top down or they happen more from the bottom up, so to speak. Real change in society tends to be a grassroots movement. No effort throughout all of history to take an idea and impose it on people has ever worked. You have the example of communist dictatorships who, if for the good of the people, were going to make everyone equal, and in order to make everyone equal, they've had to kill millions of their own people, literally, hundreds of thousands at least, to make everybody feel good and be equal. It just doesn't happen like that. It happens because, cosmically speaking, what I really want to say is the good news is this world is not really run by the people in a position of worldly power. I say thank God. When Swamiji and I were talking, Swami Kriyananda and I were discussing the American presidential election, which is of greater interest to us than it usually is, because it's just more interesting than it usually is, he was commenting, quite simply, it's just a matter of the karma of the country, who we end up with. Speaking in that light, Master commenting on Hitler as an example, who was certainly an example of a terrible national leader, about as bad as you can imagine, said that Hitler personally wasn't entirely responsible. It was the karma of the nation, and he was simply the instrument of that karma. It's an interesting way to look at it, and deeply reassuring, I might add. In the book, The Path, which is Swami Kriyananda's autobiography, in which he describes his own search for spiritual meaning and then his coming to become a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda, then his years with Master, at the end of that book, there's a chapter. Now I can't recall the name of it, but the beginning of it, it's about Master's last days, that's what it's called. And he talks at the introduction to that is this exquisitely beautiful essay about spiritual family and about avatars, about the great masters who come to this planet, not just once, but often repeatedly, souls who have themselves traversed through the very jungle of misunderstanding that all of us are walking, which is trying to discern the difference between the infinite self and the ego self, and trying to hear the voice that speaks to us of lasting happiness, which is so often drowned out by the voice that speaks of immediate pleasure. It's very interesting in this emotional IQ trend that's also going around. They were testing children to find out really what is the characteristics of success that they could quantify, because the intellectual tests that they were giving of just IQ seemed to be indicative only of IQ, not necessarily of success in life. But there are these other factors that determine whether or not a person can face the challenges of life and really succeed. And one of the tests was absolutely charming to me. They took very small children and they put them in a room with a cookie. And they told the child, there was the cookie and there was the child, and then the adult said to the child, I'm going to leave you alone in here for a few minutes. If you don't eat this cookie, when I come back, I'll give you two. And then the child would sit there and they would observe them through a one-way glass, and the child would have to resist the temptation to eat the one cookie for the sake of two cookies later. And I don't know how they run these tests, but they must have done it over a long period of time. But every child who could resist eating the cookie for the sake of having two proved later to be a success in life. And the ones who just said, I don't care about two cookies, I'll just eat the one, always had difficulty later. Isn't that an interesting fact? I mean, it's such a simple fact, because that says that a person can remove themselves just a little bit from the immediate pressure of desire and think in terms of the longer rhythms. I mean, we train people in our schools, and it's entirely a self-sustaining system where you're trained to be able to be good in school so that you can be good in school so that you can go to other good schools. And the theory is that somewhere down the line in all of this, you will finally get what you want, which is a prestigious job with some company, which you may or may not be able to handle because you won't any longer be in school. But if you absolutely manage to handle it, but none of that guarantees real happiness, because happiness is not based on these artificial systems. Happiness is based on the inner ability to master ourselves. I was talking to a young friend of mine who had a certain attraction to these teachings, because he found it, he had many reasons for being attracted. At the same time, being a young man, he was very ambitious and had a tremendous number of personal desires that he wanted to see fulfilled. And he was concerned that there was a conflict between these teachings as it was presented, which is easy to understand because it says, we are not this world, it doesn't matter what you accomplish in this world is just a dream. Well, you can see somebody who wants to experience the dream would be a little reluctant to accept that. But that's really a false way to present the teachings. I put it more to him this way, and he was intuitive enough to understand. And I spoke to him about various things that he's trying to do, academically, artistically, interpersonally. I said, what's the biggest obstacle to all of your accomplishments? I said, it's certainly not your intelligence or your talent, because in his case, he was very gifted. I said, it's your ability to direct your energy, isn't it? It's the ability to master your moods. It's the ability to, not eat the one cookie and wait for the two. Isn't that it? In other words, self-mastery. Self-mastery, that's everything. And then everything else follows naturally from that. Our relationships are harmonious, our goals are achieved, we know how to work hard, we can work smart. But without self-mastery, we get so confused. Swamiji said it to me once when I had made a complete hash of a very simple situation. He gave me one of those just gems of usefulness. Oh, Asha, he said, very sweetly, so my feelings weren't hurt. Oh, Asha, he said, whenever your ego gets involved, you make terrible decisions. It's just like so many times in my life I've just seen that. It just seemed like a good idea at the time because I was blinded by the essence of that desire for the one cookie. Whether it was anxiety that made me make too hasty a decision, desire for self-importance or self-concern, whatever it might be, it moves us off of that center point. And once we're off of that center point, we make terrible decisions. But of course, that is the process of life, and it's not a question of renouncing these life experiences. That's not the path we're on now. There have been times in the history of spiritual development where everybody who was serious got to be in a cloister. You might not think of that as a treat. Some of us think of that as a real treat. But anyway, got to be in a cloister or a cave or in a desert solitude somewhere. The whole level of society was just so low that there was no possibility of integrating deep spirituality in everyday life. So people went aside. That's been the picture of the last centuries. But we're in a completely new reality now. We're in a reality where spirituality is entirely a matter of our own inner experience of it. We have to individually make love to God, is how Master put it. And he also put it this way, the only place that God can be known, he said, is in the human nervous system. It's a very strange statement. I love that statement because it's so peculiar. But what he's actually saying is, it's a matter of consciousness. It's a matter of consciousness which can be accessed right from within this human body. That's why The human being is considered to be the apex of evolution, not the whale or the monkey or the horse or any other animal creature, which has many good qualities and in certain ways has certain seeming talents above the human being. But the nervous system of any other creature is not refined enough for the individual consciousness within it to perceive infinity. And that's the great unused portion of the human brain, is that in fact it's meant to be used. As Dr. Peter at Ananda Village put it, he says, the human body was engineered for divinity, engineered to perceive the presence of God. And the avatars, the great masters, have started as we have started, manifested from God as individual souls. You want to hear something just so astonishing. Paramhansa Yogananda, from the point of self-realization, which he attained many lifetimes before he came as Yogananda, he's appeared on this planet many times before in exactly the same role, different personality, different name, but still in the role of world teacher as he has appeared this time. He said he consciously remembers that which is his individual nature, the jiva you would call it, back to the level of being a diamond, evolving from the level of a diamond to the level of a master. Don't even think about how long that takes. It's just not worth it, because here we are, we're in human form, and all of the scriptures speak of the tremendous opportunity that we have now, being in a human body, because the human body is engineered for divinity. That's the metaphysics of self-realization. It's a scientific fact that we can work with our concentration, with our directing our energy, with the power that's within us to become as the masters are. And that's why they come into this world with us. They walk around literally in the same human body that we're walking around in, and they show us the potential of the form we're inhabiting that we ourselves haven't yet realized. Master himself would often do, that's why they often do miraculous things through that very body. They do it not to show us that they are something unique that, you know, will never be replicated again, which is what the false devotion of their disciples tries to do. Oh, my master was the greatest of all masters. Or in Christianity, we even say he was the only one. But we're talking about absolute consciousness. How can there be any differentiation? There's a differentiation, Master himself said, only in the work that they do. You know, some come to have these, where they redirect all of history, which is what you've seen with Christianity. And Yogananda himself said that the message of self-realization that he's bringing is the message for this age. And Yogananda showed with his own body things that he could do. He, one time, a very heavy concrete cast wishing well, it was, that he was installing there at the Mount Washington. It fell on his foot and it smashed his foot, just broke the bones. And he demonstrated to the people near him. He said, look, I'm going to put my mind down to the consciousness of the body. And as soon as he did, his face was twisted in pain and he couldn't put any weight on the foot at all. He said, now I'm going to lift my consciousness above the body. And he lifted it above the body, he became perfectly serene, and he was able to walk on the foot as if it were whole. Because he was showing us that even something like feeling physical pain depends on what level of consciousness we're tuning into. And look, he stands in front of us in a human body that looks just like ours. You see the potential of this body that is yet to be realized? Now, that's just one small example, but the whole message that a master brings is saying to us, I have been where you are standing, and you will be where I am standing if you follow this path. This is my son. Walk where he leads. That's why we call it the path of self-realization, to take these steps one at a time, or 20 at a time if we can, to move into the reality where the masters are living. Now, one of the wonderful things, one of the deep and important aspects of Yogananda's particular mission at this time was this concept of Divine Mother. And it's an ideal teaching for our times, and I think the whole movement of women asserting themselves more into society, which is far from a balanced movement and has also caused a tremendous amount of confusion among both women and men, just sort of to sort all this out from these form, define traditional, rigid roles into this period of complete uncertainty to go into a period of greater harmony in which energy and consciousness are more widely understood and accepted as the reality. And in the interim, where there's always these confusing periods like we're in now, I say confusing because people are having so much difficulty finding the fulfillment that they want in terms that relate to gender, raising children, having families, holding together marriages, you know, creating stability in society. And those are all those gender-oriented ways of relating, and our society is in a very interesting transition right now. A positive one, because people are making experience the criteria. They're no longer just bound by form, trapped by form. Now people are making experience the criteria, but we haven't become sophisticated enough in our experience, because everything in our society tells us to eat that one cookie as soon as we can. And that is not a recipe for success. But coming back to this, what is trying to happen spiritually at this point? What this particular avatar, which is Paramahansa Yogananda, has come to bring us is a very intimate picture of our relationship with God. The Whispers from Eternity that we read every week, that Claire was reading today, and those of you, many of you are new today, others of you come every week. Whispers from Eternity is a small book of what Master called, Paramahansa Yogananda called, I want to use the word realized prayers. Prayers that he prayed and received a divine answer. Prayers that work. It's an instruction book for how to pray. It's beautifully poetic and marvelously imaginative in the images that he uses. And the words roll out. It's very intuitive. It's not carefully and reasoned out and counted. It's just a spontaneous flow of inspiration. But what you find in that is this conversational relationship with the divine force in all these different ways in which we demand of God and we scold God and we bare our souls to God. And it's not that we have to use those prayers as they're written, although Master did suggest that we memorize them one at a time, he said, and repeat them over and over until we receive the response that he received through them. But what they teach us is that that relationship with God has no boundaries. It's not about somebody else's dogma. So many people that I meet who call themselves agnostics or even atheists, I say, instead of in my position, you would think that I would be horrified by the blasphemy of that. But so often I say, well, congratulations, because what you've done is you've rejected concepts of God that really ought to be rejected. The word has no meaning in the English language unless you give it a dogmatic definition. But what we're really talking about is the experience of fulfillment. The heart's longing. Our hearts are restless, St. Augustine said, until they find their rest in thee. We have this intuitive longing for deep fulfillment. That's why we struggle so much in life. If we deeply believed that we were really meant to suffer and be unhappy, we wouldn't be unhappy. It would just be the way things are. Do you see what I mean? It's that intuitive knowing that this is not the way it is meant to be. And then, of course, it is looking in the wrong direction and imagining that we can make up our own rules for life and still be fulfilled. That's why it takes us so many incarnations. We just keep eating that one cookie and then demanding the whole box. And we can't understand why the box is not given to us. But I want it. Didn't you hear me? Excuse me. Don't you understand? This is what I want. Oh, no, no. Don't you know? I want this right now. That's what we say to life so much of the time, isn't it? I'm not going to be disciplined. I'm not going to be generous. I'm not going to really apply myself. I'm not going to think beyond my body and my ego. But I want total fulfillment. What's wrong with that, we say. And our whole society, God bless its ignorance, it's just really out there telling us that's the way to go. But experience doesn't support it. It's as simple as that. Experience does not support it. And so gradually, over many lifetimes, we begin to wake up. I was beginning to come back, and I want to speak of this. The difficulty when we start speaking of God in this way is that we get very confused. We don't know what we're talking about. Sister Gyanamata, who was Master's most advanced woman disciple, gave wonderful advice for being a devotee. And I'm paraphrasing her, but this is in essence what she said. She said, you cannot find fulfillment by trying to live somebody else's destiny. You can't find fulfillment by just trying to paste upon yourself high ideals that you read somewhere. And what she suggested we do is, as she put it, she said, you need to back up in your spiritual life. In other words, you have to keep reducing the reality of your spiritual life until you find a place where you can stand with absolute certainty of the truth of it. I mean, I'll put it in a specific way. Sometimes we have affirmations, I am perfect, I am one with the infinite spirit, I am one with the infinite light. And maybe your consciousness can easily go out into that reality. But sometimes the more you affirm these perfect ideals, the more literally your own subconscious says to you, that's not true. You're selfish, you're greedy, you're lazy. Not you, God doesn't really love you. And sometimes the more we affirm in these really elevated ways, really it makes us psychologically sicker, because we're actually, the subconscious is picking up the wrong message. So we have to, in our spiritual life, we have to pray in such a way, an affirmation is just a form of prayer, that we can wholeheartedly believe it. And sometimes that prayer is, Divine Mother, and Master has this prayer. I love this. When Master prays to Divine Mother, we have this little thing that he writes. He says, essentially, I know, Divine Mother, that I have been a very naughty boy, that I have really done almost nothing that you asked me to do, but you have such a great heart. I know you'll forgive me no matter what I do, and that if I just crawl into your lap and hold on to you, I will melt your heart with my love. Like that. Now, maybe you can't believe that either. But somewhere, somehow, when I was very early on the spiritual path, Swamiji once, he was passing out compliments. He was writing the path at that time, actually, his autobiography. And he put in a few paragraphs, which he later took out, in which he specifically named certain people and said certain. Am I remembering this correctly? I believe that's true. But he just named a few people and talked about their fine qualities. It was either for that book or for something else. And, you know, it was lovely. But he was passing out compliments. That's why I think maybe it wasn't part of the book. He was passing out compliments. So I put myself into his line of sight, you know, in the hope that my presence would force him to say something nice. So, of course, he knew exactly what I was doing. And he knew that it would be crushing to me if he said nothing. And at the same time, he was going to be very honest. He looked right at me and he said, Asha, you're very sincere. Now, to me, I thought, oh, damning with faint praise. That's what I heard. You know, like sincere, like he'd gone through the whole list of positive adjectives and that was the bottom of the pile. And I sort of, you know, became a little discouraged. And somehow or another, and I don't know whether it was immediately or afterwards, he inquired as to why I was responding that way. And I explained to him. But then he looked at me so seriously, I remember so vividly. He said, Asha, sincerity is everything. Because once we are honestly and truly, and that's what sincerity means, it's not a put-on. This is not like, oh, I'm trying to be a devotee. I'm going to wear white clothes and speak softly and refer to myself as this unit of consciousness. You know, it's like a deeply honest. There was a friend of mine who was a spiritual teacher. She used to travel and teach a lot, and she was giving a class, and we were visiting together. And I said, well, maybe I need to leave you so you can get ready for your class. And she said, too late, too late. What you see is what you get. Just like that. Meaning it's just like I've been doing this for a long time, and it's too late to make myself better than I am. This is just it. It was so charming. I always love that. What you see is what you get. Okay? That's sincerity. That's like, I'm doing the best I can. And then I made up for myself after that a mantra called, if I could have done better, I would have done better. Right? Because, of course, if we could have done better, we would have done better. No one gets up and says, oh, I think I'll see if I can make a total hash of my life and as many people as I touch today. You know, we may actually do that, but we always somewhere thought it was a good idea. You know, it seemed like a good idea at the time. But that sincerity, and if you can't claim anything else on the spiritual path, and as I said, I made my mantra for many, many years, my mantra was my self-comforting mantra, was, I am a sincere devotee. And then I would say, and if this is what happens to sincere devotees, this is what happens to sincere devotees. Meaning, if I mess up as many times as I've messed up, if I cause so much trouble, if I get so confused, I guess this is what happens to sincere devotees. Because I had reduced my spiritual path to the point where I could stand without any doubt on any level. We may not be good, but at least we're sincere. Now, the experience that we have of God has to be one of infinite, intimate comfort. And that's why Master brought out that image of Divine Mother. Maybe in your life your human mother was deeply satisfying, maybe she wasn't. But the image of comforting, feminine love, woman or man, doesn't make any difference. It's a quality of divine consciousness. What is that quality? Masculine quality, which is essential for success in life, is more demanding. It looks to the goal. It goes forward. If we have sufficient, insufficient yang energy, which is a neutral way to describe that, then we also can't accomplish. But if we have insufficiency of yin energy, of feminine energy in our lives, then we become brittle and frightened and sometimes too harsh. And that's what we see in our culture. That's why the yin, the feminine, is trying to come forward. That's why Master's trying to bring it out even in a divine way. It's not God of wrath who's trying to force us to do this and make us do things that are not in our own nature. God is a mother to us. The most deeply comforting of all mothers. We all want the right thing for a very simple reason. We all want bliss. The only reason we don't accomplish it, we lack courage, we're afraid, we lack understanding. How will that be overcome? That will be overcome above all by being comforted. That's why even in the Bible, they speak of the Om vibration. That's what Jesus was referring to. After I am gone, Jesus said, I will send you the Comforter. I read those words so often in the Bible. I will send you the Comforter. Isn't that thrilling? On a more metaphysical level, that means the Om vibration, but the Om vibration is the feminine form. Divine Mother is the Om vibration, and the reason for that is because the Om vibration is deeply within us. It is our very nature. Master says, his voice says on this wonderful little tape, this is like just puts an end to all gender discussion about divinity. He says, when you pray to Master as Divine Mother. He can't resist you when you do that. Right? The infinite power takes the form of the compassionate mother. Make that your religion. The compassionate, intimate love of the mother. Because that's a solid ground upon which we can stand. And then we can have the courage to accept the challenge that the Father gives us. To rise to greatness within us, to accept the example that the avatars give us, who are the perfect blend of that deeply compassionate, loving understanding, I've been there, I've walked that way, I will help you, and the great power that says, you can do it, and you will.